Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis, continuing on cassette number 3, side 1. The creature struck itself on the chest and made a noise. Branson did not first realize what it meant. Then he saw that it was trying to teach him its name, presumably the name of the species. Cross, it said. Cross, and flapped itself. Cross, repeated Ransom, and pointed at it. Then, man, and struck his own chest. Meh, meh, men, imitated the cross. It picked up a handful of earth, where earth appeared between weed and water at the bank of the lake. Hundra, it said. Ransom repeated the word. Then an idea occurred to him. Malacandra, he said in an inquiring voice. The cross rolled its eyes and waved its arms, obviously in an effort to indicate the whole landscape. Ransom was getting on well. Randa was earth, the element. Malacandra, the earth or planet as a whole. Soon he would find out what Malak meant. In the meantime, H disappears after C, he noted, and made his first step in Malacandrian phonetics. The cross was now trying to teach him the meaning of Handramit. He recognized the root Handra again, and noted that they have suffixes as well as prefixes. But this time he could make nothing of the cross's gestures, and remained ignorant what a Handramit might be. He took the initiative by opening his mouth, pointing to it, and going through the pantomime of eating. The Malacandrian word for food, or eat, which he got in return, proved to contain consonants unreproducible by a human mouth, and Ransom, continuing the pantomime, tried to explain that his interest was practical as well as philological. The cross understood him, though he took some time to understand from its gestures that it was inviting him to follow it. In the end, he did so. It took him only as far as where it had got the shell, and here, to his not very reasonable astonishment, Ransom found that a kind of boat was moored. Manlike, when he saw the artifact, he felt more certain of the cross's rationality. He even valued the creature the more because the boat, allowing for the usual Malacandrian height and flimsiness, was really very like an earthly boat. Only later did he set himself the question, what else could a boat be like? The cross produced an oval platter of some tough but slightly flexible material, covered it with strips of a spongy orange-colored substance, and gave it to Ransom. He cut a convenient length off with his knife and began to eat, doubtfully at first, and then ravenously. It had a bean-like taste, but sweeter, good enough for a starving man. Then, as his hunger ebbed, the sense of his situation returned with dismaying force. The huge, seal-like creature seated beside him became unbearably ominous. It seemed friendly, but it was very big, very black, and he knew nothing about it. What were its relations to the swords? And was it really as rational as it appeared? It was only many days later that Ransom discovered how to deal with these sudden losses of confidence. They arose when the rationality of the cross tempted you to think of it as a man. Then it became abominable, a man 7 feet high, with a snaky body, covered, face and all, with thick black animal hair and whiskered like a cat. But starting from the other end, you had an animal with everything an animal ought to have, glossy coat, liquid eye, sweet breath, and whitest teeth. And added to all these, as though paradise had never been lost and earliest dreams were true, the charm of speech and reason. Nothing could be more disgusting than the one impression, nothing more delightful than the other. It all depended on the point of view. Chapter 10. When Ransom had finished his meal and drunk again of the strong waters of Malacandra, his host rose and entered the boat. He did this head first, like an animal, his sinuous body allowing him to rest his hands on the bottom of the boat while his feet were still planted on the land. He completed the operation by flinging rump, tail, and hind legs all together about 5 feet into the air, and then whisking them neatly on board with an agility which would have been quite impossible to an animal of his bulk on earth. Having got into the boat, he proceeded to get out again, and then pointed to it. Ransom understood that he was being invited to follow his example. The question which he wanted to ask above all others could not, of course, be put. Were the crosser, he discovered later that this was the plural of cross, the dominant species on Malacandra, and the sorns, despite their more man-like shape, merely a semi-intelligent kind of cattle? Fervently he hoped that it might be so. On the other hand, the crosser might be the domestic animals of the sorns, in which case the latter would be super-intelligent. His whole imaginative training somehow encouraged him to associate superhuman intelligence with monstrosity of form and ruthlessness of will. To step on board the Hross's boat might mean surrendering himself to Sorns at the other end of the journey. On the other hand, the Hross's invitation might be a golden opportunity of leaving the Sorn-haunted forests forever. And by this time, the Hross itself was becoming puzzled at his apparent inability to understand it. The urgency of its signs finally determined him. The thought of parting from the Hross could not be seriously entertained. Its animality shocked him in a dozen ways, but his longing to learn its language, and deeper still, the shy, ineluctable fascination of unlike for unlike, the sense that the key to prodigious adventure was being put in his hands, all this had really attached him to it by bonds stronger than he knew. He stepped into the boat. The boat was without seats. It had a very high prow, an enormous expanse of freeboard, and what seemed to Ransom an impossibly shallow draft. Indeed, very little of it even rested on the water. He was reminded of a modern European speedboat. It was moored by something that looked at first like rope, but the Hross cast off not by untying, but by simply pulling the apparent rope in two, as one might pull in two a piece of soft toffee or a roll of plasticine. It then squatted down on its rump in the stern sheets and took up a paddle. A paddle of such enormous blade that Ransom wondered how the creature could wield it, till he again remembered how light a planet they were on. The length of the Hross's body enabled him to work freely in the squatting position despite the high gunwale. It paddled quickly. For the first few minutes they passed between banks wooded with the purple trees upon a waterway not more than 100 yards in width. Then they doubled a promontory, and Ransom saw that they were emerging onto a much larger sheet of water, a great lake, almost a sea. The Hross, now taking great care and often changing direction and looking about it, paddled well out from the shore. The dazzling blue expanse grew moment by moment wider around them. Ransom could not look steadily at it. The warmth from the water was oppressive. He removed his cap and jerkin, and by so doing surprised the Hross very much. He rose cautiously to a standing position and surveyed the Malacandrian prospect which had opened on every side. Before and behind them lay the glittering lake, here studded with islands, and there smiling uninterruptedly at the pale blue sky. The sun, he noticed, was almost immediately overhead. They were in the Malacandrian tropics. At each end, the lake vanished into more complicated groupings of land and water, softly, featherily embossed in the purple giant weed. But this marshy land, or chain of archipelagos, as he now beheld it, was bordered on each side with jagged walls of the pale green mountains, which he could still hardly call mountains, so tall were they, so gaunt, sharp, narrow, and seemingly unbalanced. On the starboard, they were not more than a mile away, and seemed divided from the water only by a narrow strip of forest. To the left, they were far more distant, though still impressive, perhaps 7 miles from the boat. They ran on each side of the watered country as far as he could see, both onwards and behind them. He was sailing, in fact, on the flooded floor of a majestic canyon nearly 10 miles wide and of unknown length. Behind, and sometimes above the mountain peaks, he could make out in many places great billowy piles of the rose-red substance, which he had yesterday mistaken for cloud. The mountains, in fact, seemed to have no fall of ground behind them. They were rather the serrated bastion of immeasurable tablelands, higher in many places than themselves, which made the Malacandrian horizon left and right as far as the eye could reach. Only straight ahead and straight astern was the planet cut with the vast gorge, which now appeared to him only as a rut or crack in the tableland. He wondered what the cloud-like red masses were, and endeavored to ask by signs. The question was, however, too particular for sign language. The Hross, with a wealth of gesticulation, its arms or forelimbs were more flexible than his, and in quick motion almost whip-like, made it clear that it supposed him to be asking about the high ground in general. It named this Harandra. The low-watered country, the gorge or canyon, appeared to be Handramit. Ransom grasped the implications. Handra, earth. Harandra, high earth, mountain. Handramit, low earth, valley. Highland and lowland, in fact. The peculiar importance of the distinction in Malacandrian geography he learned later. By this time, the Hross had attained the end of its careful navigation. They were a couple of miles from land when it suddenly ceased paddling and sat tense with its paddle poised in the air. At the same moment, the boat quivered and shot forward as if from a catapult. They had apparently availed themselves of some current. In a few seconds, they were racing forward at some 15 miles an hour and rising and falling on the strange, sharp, perpendicular waves of Malacandra with a jerky motion quite unlike that of the choppiest sea that Ransom had ever met on Earth. It reminded him of disastrous experiences on a trotting horse in the army, and it was intensely disagreeable. He gripped the gunwale with his left hand and mopped his brow with his right. The damp warmth from the water had become very troublesome. He wondered if the Malacandrian food, and still more the Malacandrian drink, were really digestible by a human stomach. Thank heaven he was a good sailor. At least, a fairly good sailor. At least. Hastily, he leaned over the side. Heat from blue water smote up to his face. In the depth, he thought he saw eels playing, long silver eels. The worst happened not once, but many times. In his misery, he remembered vividly the shame of being sick at a children's party, long ago in the star where he was born. He felt a similar shame now. It was not thus that the first representative of humanity would choose to appear before a new species. Did Frosser vomit too? Would it know what he was doing? Shaking and groaning, he turned back into the boat. The creature was keeping an eye on him, but its face seemed to him expressionless. It was only long after that he learned to read the Malacandrian face. The current, meanwhile, seemed to be gathering speed. In a huge curve, they swung across the lake to within a furlong of the farther shore, then back again, and once more onward, in giddy spirals and figures of eight, while purple wood and jagged mountain raced backwards, and Ransom loathingly associated their sinuous course with the nauseous curling of the silver eels. He was rapidly losing all interest in Malacandra. The distinction between Earth and other planets seemed of no importance compared with the awful distinction of Earth and water. He wondered despairingly whether the Hross habitually lived on water. Perhaps they were going to spend the night in this detestable boat. His sufferings did not, in fact, last long. There came a blessed cessation of the choppy movement and a slackening of speed, and he saw that the Hross was backing water rapidly. They were still afloat, with shores close on each side. Between them, a narrow channel in which the water hissed furiously, apparently a shallow. The Hross jumped overboard, splashing abundance of warm water into the ship. Ransom, more cautiously and shakily, clambered after it. He was about up to his knees. To his astonishment, the Hross, without any appearance of effort, lifted the boat bodily onto the top of its head, steadied it with one forepaw, and proceeded, erect as a Grecian caryatid, to the land. They walked forward, if the swinging movement of the Hross's short legs from its flexible hips could be called walking, beside the channel. In a few minutes, Ransom saw a new landscape. The channel was not only a shallow, but a rapid, the first, indeed, of a series of rapids by which the water descended steeply for the next half mile. The ground fell away before them, and the canyon, or Hadramit, continued at a very much lower level. Its walls, however, did not sink with it, and from his present position, Ransom got a clearer notion of the lie of the land. Far more of the highlands to the left and right were visible, sometimes covered with the cloud-like red swellings, but more often level, pale, and barren to where the smooth line of their horizon marched with the sky. The mountain peaks now appeared only as the fringe or border of the true highland, surrounding it as the lower teeth surround the tongue. He was struck by the vivid contrast between Hadramit and Hadramit. Like a rope of jewels, the gorge spread beneath him, purple, sapphire blue, yellow, and pinkish-white, a rich and variegated inlay of wooded land and disappearing, reappearing, ubiquitous water. Malacandra was less like Earth than he had been beginning to suppose. The Hadramit was no true valley rising and falling with the mountain chain it belonged to. Indeed, it did not belong to a mountain chain. It was only an enormous crack or ditch of varying depth running through the high and level Hadramit. The latter, he now began to suspect, was the true surface of the planet, certainly would appear as surface to a terrestrial astronomer. To the Hadramit itself there seemed no end. Uninterrupted and very nearly straight, it ran before him, a narrowing line of color, to where it clove the horizon with a V-shaped indenture. There must be 100 miles of it in view, he thought, and he reckoned that he had put some 30 or 40 miles of it behind him since yesterday. All this time, they were descending beside the rapids to where the water was level again, and the Foss could relaunch its skiff. During this walk, Ransom learned the words for boat, rapid, water, sun, and carry. The latter, as his first verb, interested him particularly. The Foss was also at some pains to impress upon him an association or relation which it tried to convey by repeating the contrasting pairs of words Fossahandramit and Serenihandra. Ransom understood him to mean that the Fossa lived down in the Handramit and the Sereni up on the Harandra. What the deuce was Sereni, he wondered. The open reaches of the Harandra did not look as if anything lived up there. Perhaps the Fossa had a mythology. He took it for granted they were on a low cultural level, and the Sereni were gods or demons. The journey continued with frequent, though decreasing, recurrences of nausea for Ransom. Hours later, he realized that Sereni might very well be the plural of Sorn. The sun declined on their right. It dropped quicker than on Earth, or at least on those parts of Earth that Ransom knew, and in the cloudless sky it had little sunset pomp about it. In some other queer way, which he could not specify, it differed from the sun he knew. But even while he speculated, the needle-like mountaintops stood out black against it, and the Handramit grew dark, though eastward, to their left, the high country of the Harandra still shone pale rose, remote and smooth and tranquil, like another and more spiritual world. Soon he became aware that they were landing again, that they were treading solid ground, were making for the depth of the purple forest. The motion of the boat still worked in his fantasy, and the earth seemed to sway beneath him. This, with weariness and twilight, made the rest of the journey dreamlike. Light began to glare in his eyes. A fire was burning. It illuminated the huge leaves overhead, and he saw stars beyond them. Dozens of Fossa seemed to have surrounded him, more animal, less human in their multitude and their close neighborhood to him than his solitary guide had seemed. He felt some fear, but more a ghastly inappropriateness. He wanted men, any men, even Western and divine. He was too tired to do anything about all these meaningless bullet heads and fairy faces, could make no response at all. And then, lower down, closer to him, more mobile, came in throngs the whelps, the puppies, the cubs, whatever you called them. Suddenly his mood changed. They were jolly little things. He laid his hand on one black head and smiled. The creature scurried away. He never could remember much of that evening. There was more eating and drinking. There was continual coming and going of black forms. There were strange eyes luminous in the firelight. Finally, there was sleep in some dark, apparently covered place. Chapter 11. Ever since he awoke on the spaceship, Ransom had been thinking about the amazing adventure of going to another planet, and about his chances of returning from it. What he had not thought about was being on it. It was with a kind of stupefaction each morning that he found himself neither arriving in nor escaping from, but simply living on Malacandra, waking, sleeping, eating, swimming, and even, as the days passed, talking. The wonder of it smote him most strongly when he found himself, about 3 weeks after his arrival, actually going for a walk. A few weeks later, he had his favorite walks and his favorite foods. He was beginning to develop habits. He knew a male from a female horse at sight, and even individual differences were becoming plain. Shoy, who had first found him, miles away to the north, was a very different person from the gray-muzzled, venerable Snohra, who was daily teaching him the language. And the young of the species were different again. They were delightful. You could forget all about the rationality of Fossa in dealing with them. Too young to trouble him with the baffling enigma of reason in an inhuman form, they solaced his loneliness, as if he had been allowed to bring a few dogs with him from the earth. The cubs, on their part, felt the liveliest interest in the hairless goblin which had appeared among them. With them, and therefore indirectly with their dams, he was a brilliant success. Of the community in general, his earlier impressions were all gradually being corrected. His first diagnosis of their culture was what he called Old Stone Age. The few cutting instruments they possessed were made of stone. They seemed to have no pottery, but a few clumsy vessels used for boiling, and boiling was the only cookery they attempted. Their common drinking vessel, dish, and ladle, all in one, was the oyster-like shell in which he had first tasted Hwas' hospitality. The fish which it contained was their only animal food. Vegetable fare they had in great plenty and variety, some of it delicious. Even the pinkish-white weed which covered the whole Hadhramit was edible at a pinch, so that if he had starved before Hyori found him, he would have starved amidst abundance. No Hwas, however, ate the weed, Honadraskrud, for choice, though it might be used faute de mieux on a journey. Their dwellings were beehive-shaped huts of stiff leaf, and the villages, there were several in the neighborhood, were always built beside rivers for warmth and well upstream towards the walls of the Hadhramit where the water was hottest. They slept on the ground. They seemed to have no arts, except a kind of poetry and music which was practiced almost every evening by a team or troop of four Hossa. One recited half-chanting at great length, while the other three, sometimes singly and sometimes antiphonally, interrupted him from time to time with song. Ransom could not find out whether these interruptions were simply lyrical interludes or dramatic dialogue arising out of the leader's narrative. He could make nothing of the music. The voices were not disagreeable, and the scale seemed adapted to human ears, but the time pattern was meaningless to his sense of rhythm. The occupations of the tribe or family were at first mysterious. People were always disappearing for a few days and reappearing again. There was a little fishing and much journeying in boats, of which he never discovered the object. Then one day he saw a kind of caravan of Hossa setting out by land, each with a load of vegetable food on its head. Apparently there was some kind of trade in Malacandra. He discovered their agriculture in the first week. About a mile down the Hadhramit, one came to broad lands free of forest, enclosed for many miles together in low, pulpy vegetation, in which yellow, orange, and blue predominated. Later on, there were lettuce-like plants, about the height of a terrestrial birch tree. Where one of these overhung the warmth of water, you could step into one of the lower leaves and lie deliciously as in a gently moving, fragrant hammock. Elsewhere, it was not warm enough to sit still for long out of doors. The general temperature of the Hadhramit was that of a fine winter's morning on Earth. These food-producing areas were worked communally by the surrounding villages, and division of labor had been carried to a higher point than he expected. Cutting, drying, storing, transport, and something like manuring were all carried on, and he suspected that some, at least, of the water channels were artificial. But the real revolution in his understanding of the Hossa began when he had learned enough of their language to attempt some satisfaction of their curiosity about himself. In answer to their questions, he began by saying that he had come out of the sky. Snorra immediately asked from which planet or earth, Hadhramit. Ransom, who had deliberately given a childish version of the truth in order to adapt it to the supposed ignorance of his audience, was a little annoyed to find Hnora painfully explaining to him that he could not live in the sky because there was no air in it. He might have come through the sky, but he must have come from a Hadhramit. He was quite unable to point Earth out to them in the night sky. They seemed surprised at his inability and repeatedly pointed out to him a bright planet low on the western horizon, a little south of where the sun had gone down. He was surprised that they selected a planet instead of a mere star and stuck to their choice. Could it be possible that they understood astronomy? Unfortunately, he still knew too little of the language to explore their knowledge. He turned the conversation by asking them the name of the bright southern planet, and was told that it was Thokandra, the silent world or planet. "Why do you call it Thok?" he asked. "Why silent?" No one knew. "The Sereni know," said Nohra. "That is the sort of thing they know." Then he was asked how he had come, and made a very poor attempt at describing the spaceship. But again, the Sereni would know. Had he come alone? No, he had come with two others of his kind, bad men. Bent men was the nearest Hossian equivalent, who tried to kill him, but he had run away from them. The Hossa found this very difficult, but all finally agreed that he ought to go to Oyasa. Oyasa would protect him. Ransom asked who Oyasa was. Slowly, and with many misunderstandings, he hammered out the information that Oyasa, 1, lived at Meldelorn, 2, knew everything and ruled everyone. 3, had always been there. And 4, was not a cross, nor one of the Sereni. Then Ransom, following his own idea, asked if Oyasa had made the world. The Hossa almost barked in the fervor of their denial. Did people in Phukandra not know that Maleldil the Young had made and still ruled the world? Even a child knew that. Where did Maleldil live? Ransom asked. With the Old One. And who was the Old One? Ransom did not understand the answer. He tried again. Where was the Old One? He is not that sort, said Snorra, that he has to live anywhere, and proceeded to a good deal which Ransom did not follow. But he followed enough to feel once more a certain irritation. Ever since he had discovered the rationality of the Hossa, he had been haunted by a conscientious scruple as to whether it might not be his duty to undertake their religious instruction. Now, as a result of his tentative efforts, he found himself being treated as if he were the savage, and being given a first sketch of civilized religion, a sort of Hossian equivalent of the shorter catechism. It became plain that Maleldil was a spirit without body, parts, or passions. He is not a Hnau, said the Hossa. What is a Hnau? Asked Ransom. You are Hnau. I am Hnau. The Sereni are Hnau. The Pfiffeltriggi are Hnau. Pfiffeltriggi, said Ransom. More than 10 days' journey to the west, said Nora. The story is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.